It was the day after, the first day of the week. I hadn't slept, and the more I laid awake, the more my mind circled through the last 3 years. All the mentions of death, of suffering, of wheat falling into the ground and dying. What was it all for? This wasn't at all what we had expected. A cross, perhaps, but why didn't he save himself? Suffering, perhaps, but if he could raise Lazarus from the dead, why couldn't he save himself from death? It was as if all the last few years were for nothing. The ache, the confusion, the disappointment, and the anger were all rolling around inside of me. The world once again felt formless and void, full of chaos and darkness. I had thought he would never leave. It just didn't make sense. So, instead of rolling around on my mat, trying aimlessly to get a moment or two of rest, I just got up and started walking to the place where my gut ached to go, where the pain would be most acute, but where I could at least be in his presence again, even if just his body. The sun hadn't yet risen, so darkness still covered the countryside. It had been raining since the previous evening and all throughout the night, so the ground was quite wet and soggy, and I had to avoid puddles as I trudged through the mud. The 12 were too afraid to go out in public, for fear of the same thing happening to them. So I offered, along with a few of the other women, to go to the tomb and complete the burial process. Because of the Sabbath, we couldn't go until today. But as we turned a corner and came in view of the tomb, my heart dropped into my stomach and I gasped. The stone had been rolled away, and the entrance to the tomb was wide open. Sheer terror came over me, and in a panic, I left the other women behind and rushed back to the house where I knew the 12 were staying. John would know what to do.
I don't know if you've been through a period of grief before, of deep grief, of truly traumatic grief. And then the first night, you know, after whatever happened, and you can't sleep. You're sleepless for like 2 days. But then a day later, your body shuts down and takes over, and you just go out cold for the entire night and sleep hard and wake up in the same position that you laid down in the night before, even though it wasn't the most comfortable position. Well, that's how I was sleeping. And from what I could tell, Peter was sleeping beside me when Mary burst in to where Peter and I had conked out. And with none too little emotion, you know, breathing heavy through tears and gasping for air, Mary took us into a totally clear-headed wakefulness when she grabbed us by the shoulders as we're laying down and said, "He's gone. They've taken him. They've taken the Lord." I remember when I heard her say that, my eyes popped open like jack-in-the-box lids, and the light from the breaking day, man, it was early, it was the first break of dawn, shone directly into my eyes. I felt like a surge of energy rise up within me. It wasn't fear or excitement or panic. It was all too soon for that. For now, it was just pure, untamed energy, like a geyser pressure washing my insides. Along with Peter, we tossed the sheets off, looked at each other straight in the eyes, and then a blink, a knowing nod, and Peter just shot off like some kind of slingshot. Just like that. It was so characteristic of Peter. Peter, without a word, just started moving like that. As quickly as he had drawn his sword and lopped off the soldier's ear a few nights before without a second's thought, so now he made like your famous runner, Usain Bolt, and bolted out the door like lightning. Zoom, he was gone. Naturally, Mary and myself followed after Peter toward the tomb. And you know, I don't know if you've had this, but even in moments of grief, serious grief, funny things can happen. And it was pretty funny because Peter had all this energy and ran off ahead of us. And then I caught up to him after just a couple of minutes, went straight by him at the tomb way before he even got there. It was kind of funny. In any event, what we saw when we got to the tomb only confirmed our suspicions. All the evidence pointed in one direction. The Lord's body, bless it, the Lord's body. It had been stolen by the Jews in the night. We'd heard rumors about their plans to do it, but those were only rumors. But then Mary said it happened, and now the evidence was clear. We saw it with our own two eyes. That's exactly what happened. After all, the evidence was clear. The tomb was empty, and all that was left behind were remnants of Jesus' burial clothes, you know, strips of linen over here, a burial cloth over there, but no Jesus. Jesus himself, as dead men do, was nowhere to be found.
I came to the house, and as I burst through the door, I shouted at them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him." The men all looked at me with shock. Had they not known me, they probably wouldn't have believed me. But chaos erupted in the house, and immediately Peter and John bolted out of their beds and rushed past me out of the house and towards the garden where the tomb had been cut. The tomb was a fair distance away, and I was so fatigued from the first run, I couldn't keep up with them. Peter was definitely in the lead, not sure what happened to John. But by the time I reached it, gasping for air, the two men were standing outside of the entrance with looks of disbelief. They didn't know what to do either. Feeling defeated and utterly hopeless, I walked past them to gaze into the tomb myself. Nothing. Just the strips of linen lying there and the cloth that had been wrapped around his head. Side by side, not disheveled or thrown about, as if his body had just evaporated. Why would somebody do this? Why would somebody take his body and then leave the linen lying neatly on the bench? When I turned back around, Peter and John had already started walking back. The woman had left, but my feet remained plastered to the entrance of the tomb. Trembling and unable to hold back my emotions, I leaned against the stone and wept.
Peter and I decided we wanted to return to where we were staying to confirm Mary's report for the others. As we walked back, we reflected a bit on what we were thinking and feeling. And basically, as I remember it, we ruminated on how much of a terrible disappointment all of this had been. We had seriously hoped Jesus was the one, and really thought he was. And we had our reasons. There were his unparalleled words. There were his unparalleled deeds. But clearly now we were wrong. Dead wrong. All of our hopes concerning Jesus of Nazareth had come crashing down around us in this dreadful defeat. And the Jews who stole him had just added insult to injury. And you know, friends, the more we thought about that and gave utterance to it, the more it deepened our pain. Everything given our present perspective took on the hue of gloom. And nearly every memory only deepened our sense of pain and sorrow and desolation. I mean, from the moment they arrested him and stole his freedom, how could they? And then to the mocking crown of thorns, to his dry lips and cry from the cross, "I thirst." He, thirsting. From his declaration of defeat on the cross when he said, "It is finished," before giving up his spirit, before dying. And then all the way down to that side-splitting spear, which instantly drained his pummeled body of all of his remaining fluid, causing blood and water to gush out. And now this. Talk about insult to injury. Stolen. Desecrated. Goodness. I have to tell you, everything looked bad from our present perspective on things. At that moment, everything looked so dreadfully bad.
After a few moments, I turned to look back into the tomb, thinking that I might as well take the linens with me. But I almost fell backwards in surprise. There inside were two beings dressed completely in white, who definitely had not been there before. They were seated exactly where I had just been looking, exactly where Peter and John had just been searching, right where his body was supposed to be. One where the head had been, and one at the feet. I fell to my knees, overwhelmed with fear and sadness. Were these messengers of God? Angels? Cherubim? Why were they here? And why had they only shown up now? But before I could even begin to process this, one of them asked me, "Woman, why are you crying?" As if they didn't know. What kind of question was that? "They've taken my Lord away," I said, "and I don't know where they have put him." I mean, it must have taken at least 10 men to roll away the stone. What a horrible, horrible trick. To take his body and likely leave it in a criminal's tomb, or worse, to not even bury it at all. No one would be able to visit him now, to bestow any final acts of love. Now there was no faith, no hope, no maybe after all. He was gone, in every way possible. I felt anger stirring within me, complete hatred for those who had dared to deplete him of any honor after death, to take that away from him, to take it away from us. I turned away from the tomb in my frustration and nearly ran into somebody else who I assumed must be the gardener. Not wanting him to see the tears that were forming in my eyes, I turned to the ground and continued to keep walking away. But oddly, he stopped me and asked me the same question. "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it that you are looking for?" I was getting a little tired of all of these questions. I was looking for my Lord, whose body was supposed to be here, but he was gone. He was gone. Maybe this man had taken him away for some reason. It didn't make sense. The gardeners had no authority in that matter to do that. But regardless, the chaos within me and the anger still burned, and I had nothing to lose, so I said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, please tell me where you have put him, and I will go and get him." There was a beat, and then the man said softly, "Mary."
After we'd been home a while, Mary came back, saying, "He is risen. He's risen. I've seen him. I've seen him. We spoke. He told me to come and tell you that we spoke and that I saw him." And listen, folks, I've got to tell you, you know, cultures have their things, okay? And women in our culture, well, they weren't considered the most believable of witnesses because we had kind of concluded in our day that women are a bit too emotional to be trusted. But it was hard not to believe Mary when she came to us. You know, she was not known to lie. She was not known to be hysterical. She was not known to be given to fits of delusion. And her face, glory, it's as though she really saw something. It's as though she really saw him.
The man said my name. How did he know my name? And why would he use it like this in public? And why did he say it to me so tenderly? No man had ever spoken to me like that before with such tenderness, such compassion, such understanding. No one. Except one. And then I knew. It was my beloved teacher. And I screamed at him, "Rabbi!" and fell at his feet. Looking back, I had no concept of why, how, when, by what means. In that moment, all I knew was that he was here. He was here. Alive, in the flesh. Different, and yet the same. Familiar, and yet unknowable. And my whole being fell at his feet, and I held on to him in sheer disbelief. Even if this was just a dream or a delusion, I was going to hold on to him as best as I could and as long as I could. But then he said to me, Do not hold on to me. And I couldn't believe it. What? Why? I just got you back. Why would you say that to me? Aren't you happy to see me too? What are you talking about? Or was he leaving again? Because then he said to me, do not hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father.
And her report of what happened had all the characteristics of the Lord, just the sort of things he would do and say. You know, a tender question. Mary, why are you crying? And then a more penetrating and familiar question. Whom do you seek? Or what do you seek? It's the exact same question, in fact, that Jesus first asked us, his disciples. As John records at the beginning of his gospel, he said to us when he first met us, whom do you seek? Or what do you seek? And now he asks Mary the same thing. It's like a signature question of his. Whom do you seek? What do you seek? And then our Lord again, the pulling back of the covers, the moment of revelation, just as Jesus always did with his teaching. There was always a sudden moment where we'd go, that's it. Now I get it. And now he did it with his person. It was like a little mini apocalypse for Mary. Oh, he's not a gardener, as Mary learned. But Mary, it's me, the Lord, your rabbi. Yes, it was Jesus, the Lord, come back from the dead. Not resuscitated. No, not resuscitated. But truly risen up from the dead with a new glorified immortal body. Brilliant.
And then suddenly everything started clicking into place. That's why he came. That was why he had come. This was the start of something completely new. New creation was spilling over into the world just as he said it would. Just as at the very beginning of creation. A bridge had been formed between God and his people. This was the start of a new relationship, a new covenant that had been formed. Because then he said to me, go. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. And it took me a minute to realize what he was saying to me. He was sending me. He was sending me to deliver the message that he was alive and that a new thing was happening. I had to go. Goodness knows why he was sending me to do this, why he had chose me to do this. It was impossible for me to accept, let alone anyone who hadn't seen what I had just seen. Who would believe me? Who would believe this and then also believe that he was sending me to testify to it? I hated to leave him. I didn't want to leave him. And yet I knew that this would be the most important thing I would ever do. I had to go and tell the others. We only had so much time. So I ran. With what felt like a new breath in my lungs, I ran and I ran and I ran until I reached that house and I burst through the door for a second time. But this time, it wasn't an empty tomb I was proclaiming. I shouted at them, I have seen the Lord. I have seen the Lord.
And we believed it, friends, without seeing. Without seeing. We'd see it later, but we believed it first. Yeah, we did. Simply on the basis of Mary's eyewitness testimony, we believed it. Well, all of us except Thomas, which is another story for another time. But for those of us who did believe her testimony, you know what happened? It changed everything. Our view of everything, absolutely everything. From the whole arrest and crucifixion right on down to what happened on Easter morning had changed with a snap, and it looked completely different to us now. Like we put on an entirely different set of glasses, or maybe even more accurately, like a new set of lenses was set behind our eyes through which now we perceive the world differently. Almost like in your day today, you have those stereograms where you look at a picture and then you could see into the picture and you see this 3D world. It's like now, in light of the resurrection, everything, our past, our present, our future, all became 3D. To be sure, believing that Jesus really rose from the dead cast everything, the whole dreadful defeat and empty tomb experience, into a different light. And actually, it has thrust us into embracing a life that embraces paradox. You know, paradox, where things that seem like they can't be true, or two things that don't seem like they can go together, actually do go together. Like, for example, in light of Jesus' resurrection, we now see that Jesus' arrest and loss of freedom was actually the single greatest act of freedom a human has ever expressed, leading to the greatest arrest that humanity has ever experienced, the arrest of our hearts with his love. Jesus' shameful crown of thorns was a crown of glory. Jesus thirsted from the cross precisely because he himself was never truly thirsty. Jesus' declaration that it is finished at the end was just the beginning. Jesus' split side, well, it brings everything together. Jesus gave up his spirit in order to give up the spirit. In the darkness of Easter morning, there shone the brightest light. In Jesus' death, there is life. Jesus was mistaken for a gardener because, well, he is a gardener. He's the new Adam. And Mary, John shows, is his new Eve, a portrait of the church. And I could go on and on, friends, and I'd truly, truly love to. But what I'm trying to say here to you is this. Even though you haven't seen Jesus as Mary did, as we all of us first disciples eventually did, you can believe, and you really, really should. Because it's true. It's a true story. Believe it on the basis of the eyewitness testimony. We saw, and we heard, and then we wrote it down in the Gospels and in the letters that you find in your New Testament. And we have no motive to lie to you. We were willing to risk our lives. We never saw this coming. We didn't see it coming. But it's true, so gloriously true. And you know what? When you believe as we did, what happened to us will happen to you. Everything will begin to look different. Your entire past, your entire present, your entire future. Those lenses will really take root behind your eyes. And look, I have just one question for you on this gorgeous, beautiful Easter morning. Do you believe in the Son of Man? And if so, where do you need in your life right now to look at your experience from the perspective of the resurrection? That resurrection which casts what happened on the cross in a completely different light. That defeat was victory. That death is truly life for the world. It changes everything. It really does.
Beloved of God, beloved disciples, let us tell you, it's true. Christ is risen. And may all of his children around the globe respond in return. He is risen indeed.